G'day, Mark. How are you?
Good morning, Alex. I'm well.
Oh, that's good, mate. Now, we're going to be talking about quite the name in the person and also in the national park and in the road today, aren't we?
Yeah. Mr. Benjamin Boyd. You know you've made it when you've had a road named after you in Neutral Bay.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, in Neutral Bay as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a lovely part of the world to have a name after you.
Yep. So we thought I'd just quickly, well, it won't take long because he's not here that long, as it turns out, which is interesting in itself.
Oh.
But I want to talk about this colourful Sydney identity, I think we'd call him now, Benjamin Boyd, who comes into Sydney in the early 1840s and then leaves in a blaze in the late 1840s. And in that time kind of changes, well, at least the debate or the discussion around how Australia is going to go forward, and is remembered for all sorts of reasons, but probably not the one that that he was remembered for at the time.
Jeez, that's a lot of change to make in like 10 years.
Yeah, I know. And we're going to try to get through it. Okay. So this guy, he's a Scottish stockbroker coming out of London from a fairly rich and well-to-do family, and he arrives in Sydney in 1842, in July 1842. On board his beautiful yacht called the Wanderer. And he's such a self-promoter that by the time he gets here, everyone knows he's coming, and there's sort of a parade on the harbour for his arrival. And partly he comes, he is an entrepreneur, let's to be generous, and a full-blown capitalist, to be correct, let's say. And so he comes with all these crazy plans to make money out of Australia in a time when Australia, or New South Wales in particular, is undergoing its first, or recovering from its first, economic depression. And we had had a few things happen in the late 1830s and 1840s that had rocked the economy pretty badly. One, and the main one really, was this is the end of the transportation system. So convicts, who had been kind of the labour force background of all work, really, in New South Wales, so everything from building to farming, that system had finished in 1841. And so you have this starting to dry up of the labour force, and where people, incredibly, start to demand to be paid for their work. So Boyd rolls in into the middle of this kind of economic depression with a grand scheme. One of them is to start up a steamship enterprise where he'll be running steamships up and down the coast. And steamships were a brand new kind of invention at the time and are transforming transportation all around the world, but particularly in Australia. And he's also here to try to buy up as much land and farming as he can under the old system where essentially large squatters, as we called them, could lease huge amounts of land and run sheep and cattle for basically nothing. So this is his plan. And he manages to come with so much money to do all this because him and his brothers back in Scotland have established a bank for themselves called the Royal Bank of Australia. Now, this is not a bank that you could put your own money into and it didn't issue notes and loans and all the rest. It's essentially a whole bunch of Scottish investors backing Boyd's enterprises, and he uses it as his own little private piggy bank, which, of course, without giving anything away, is not going to go well.
It sounds very capitalist of him.
Yeah, he's very, very capitalist. So here he is. Here's his plans. He's got steamships to happen. He's got sheep and cattle, and he's got his own bank. Now, he arrives in 1842 to discover, in fact, that there's already steamships running up and down the coast between Sydney and the Hunter Valley and Newcastle in particular, and also down to Port Phillip, which is now Melbourne, but was then still part of New South Wales.
Mm.
And he'd sent three ships, but only one had sort of arrived in any condition to work. So that sort of, that scheme doesn't go well at the start. So he's locked out of the main market, which is Newcastle, and his two second ships take about 12 to 18 months to actually get seaworthy. So his steamship ventures kind of don't really go anywhere, and he has to sell one of them, and then one of them gets wrecked. So we can put that back on the shelf. His second idea of running large land holdings in the Monaro and the Riverina districts, so down around the Murray River and Snowy Mountains, goes better. And he establishes himself very quickly with huge, literally, I mean, he becomes the biggest landowner in New South Wales within 12 months of being here. So he has the equivalent of about 2 or 3 million acres of land. So that's sort of an area not far off half the size of the Hunter Valley, for people who know that. And then that increases over the next few years. And he runs cattle and sheep on enormous scales. He's got like 300,000 head of cattle or something like that and 500,000 sheep. So it's massive, massive, massive.
So that one goes quite well then?
That one's going quite well. And he runs that out of a little port that he manages to get his hands on at Eden or in Twofold Bay, way down on the south coast. But he does it in the old school in that he never really ever goes there. He runs his all from his house and property in Neutral Bay. And so as his sheep, as his flocks get bigger and bigger, he sets up a wool washing facility, like a factory, in Neutral Bay. So this is the other sort of flip side to this story, is that in the mid-19th century, the Neutral Bay North Shore area was actually very industrial. It's not the kind of Neutral Bay we know.
No, very different
to now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's over there with a wool washing establishment, stores and a wharf, and he's not far away from Mossman that's running a whaling station. And so he's using his shipping industry to go down to Eden, where he's setting up this port sort of town across the bay at Twofold Bay, and bringing wool washing and stuff back and wool back to Neutral Bay, where it's all washed and then baled up and then exported. And it's going okay. However, because of his huge estate and his lack of workers, he's involved in all these schemes to try to overcome the fact that there's no longer any convicts. So before that, like I said, you could essentially have free labour where you were just giving them board and food and clothes and they would do the work. But now you have to pay for people. And Boyd, and he's not alone here, there's a whole bunch of Sydney capitalists doing the same thing, trying to come up with all different types of schemes to get cheap labour. So the first thing he decides, or he suggests, is that we can in fact bring ex-convicts back from Tasmania, about 10,000 a year, back to New South Wales to work until they get their sort of total freedom. So you've sort of still got an internal convict system, and that sort of works a bit. He does that a bit, and others do that a bit, to put them on the farms.
But it looks like that he kind of moved towards slave trading, didn't he?
Well, yeah. Now, his family in London, or in Scotland, actually had been involved in the Caribbean slave trade. So he's already got a fair idea of how this might work, I suppose. And he arrives here with all these schemes, immigration and all sorts of stuff, even including re-transporting convicts from London. But then he decides he'll experiment by going up to the South Sea Islands. So he goes up to Vanuatu and he brings back 65 men from Vanuatu to work on his farms. And now it's a little bit unclear. People are shocked by his move, although he's, again, not the only one trying to do this.
Yeah.
But he claims that he gets them to sign contracts. Now, the problem there is, of course, when they arrive in Sydney, none of them can speak English. So there's already a slight question about how they would have signed those contracts. But he ships them down to the Monaro to go to his farms. And, of course, once they start moving towards the farms in kind of a bewildered state and then see the farms, there's a second problem in that they come from Vanuatu where there are no sheep. So the next question is, they don't actually really know what to do with sheep. So why would you send them down to the Monaro?
So he essentially introduced slavery into New South Wales, but then these poor buggers who were, you know, quote unquote imported, in his words, over here, couldn't really do much use. So that didn't sound like it went very well.
That's right. So most of them, the first of the 65, he brings in about 200 in the end, but the first lot go, I think that'll do us, and start heading back towards Sydney. And we know at least 30 of them get to Sydney. Unfortunately, we don't know much about what happens to quite a lot of them. But we do know that about 30 get it back to Sydney. And they manage to get on ships and go back to the South Pacific, as do some of the others that he brings in. But what has happened is now a huge debate in Parliament has opened up saying, hang on a minute, this guy's reintroducing slavery. And we've already got rid of slavery in the British Isles in the 1830s. And now he's trying to do it here on the sly. So the government actually starts changing the laws that he, so you can't bring in these sort of labourers. Now, don't get me wrong, they're not doing it because they think slavery is a bad idea, although some of them do. Most of them are doing it because they're his business rivals, and they're a bunch of racists as well who actually just don't want Islander labour coming in and sullying the good white ex-convict labourers that are in Australia. So I'm not going to try to pretend that these guys are nice as well, but they do cut him off at the pass.
Well, I mean, thinking of that, that would mean that, that surely that's enough to drive him out of Sydney, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so he's on the nose now. People don't like him because he's tried to get convicts back. B, he's now running a slave thing. And C, as it turns out, he's been lying to his investors in Scotland the whole time, and there's no money in the bank, and he's just about to go bankrupt. So like any good capitalist entrepreneur in Sydney, either then or now, what he does is before his creditors can actually stop him, he jumps on his boat, the Wanderer, which he'd arrived in 1842, and slips out of the harbour.
Nice.
Without telling the authorities or the harbour master that he's going. So he's gone. He goes, goodbye, off to California to go to the gold fields in 1849, like you would expect. But that doesn't go so well either. So for some reason, he decides that what he should probably do is go back through the South Pacific. We're not quite sure why you would make this decision, having just run slaving ships all the way through the South Pacific, but he does. And if you haven't guessed there's a twist to this story, you might guess what it is now. He gets to the Solomon Islands, and the last we know of him is that he goes on shore with another man off the boat at Guadalcanal to go, as he says, hunting. And as it turns out, he might actually be the hunted, because the people on board his ship see him go in onto the beach and up a little stream off so where they can't actually see what's going on. And then they hear two shots. And they assume that he's shooting at animals. But then he doesn't come back. So they finally go looking for him. And it seems that Boyd and his companion were, in fact, the hunted. And they had been killed by the natives of Guadalcanal, as they called them at the time. And quite possibly, in the tradition of warriors in the Pacific at that time, we think he may have even been eaten.
Oh, what a magnificent end to Mr. Boyd. Oh, Mark, as always, you always bring us something legendary. And, yeah, what a twist at the end there. Thanks for swinging around.
That's right.